do you allow your mind, as it were, a free rein to look afresh at the Ten Commandments, or do you just simply run through them by rote? You may or you may not have been struck by this tenth commandment, that it is different from the other nine. Well, that's obvious. There are ten commandments, and the tenth commandment is different. But there is something that sets this commandment apart from the rest of the commandments. And that may make us wonder why it was given and how on earth we can establish whether or not it is being broken. But on the other hand, Paul tells us in that chapter 7 of Romans that it was the presence of this commandment in the law that actually made him aware of the full extent of his sin in his life. So what am I talking about? How is this different? Well, look at the commandment again, as it's found in Exodus 20, verse 17. You shall not covet your neighbor's house, you shall not covet your neighbor's wife, nor his male servant, nor his female servant, nor his ox, nor his donkey, nor anything that is your neighbor's. It's, as I said before, rather a mouthful, isn't it? Perhaps you might think that's what's different with this commandment. There's so much of it. But that's not what I'm talking about. So what is it that makes this commandment different from all the other commandments? It is this. It concerns an inward attitude rather than an outward attitude. An inward action or an inward attitude rather than an outward action. The state of the heart, the state of the mind, rather than our outward conduct. In short, it concerns thought, not action. And we might say, as there are very few thought readers or mind readers about, it is surely difficult to establish the breaking of this commandment. Even in our own thinking, we are often all too ready to justify our thoughts so that we don't see ourselves as breaking this commandment. But it is our duty to consider this commandment and to consider our thoughts and our actions in this matter. We ought to be aware that even if neither we nor others see this action in us, God does. I don't think we are as aware of this as we should be. Or if we are as aware of it as we should be, we don't let it affect us as we should. Do you remember that story in the Old Testament of Hagar and Ishmael? Hagar was turned out of the home of Abraham and Sarah and was there out in the desert with Ishmael. They were dying and they were alone. But then she realized something. She realized that they weren't alone. She realized that God was there. And she acknowledged that in the name that she gave to him, recorded for us in Genesis 16 and 13. You are the God who sees. Or as the NIV puts it, you are the God who sees me. And we need to have these words ingrained in our minds, particularly where this commandment is concerned. So what can we make of this 10th commandment? There are three things that I want to draw to your attention, beginning with the thought. Coveting has to do with our wanting to possess something. And this commandment about wanting to possess that which belongs to our neighbour. And as I say, our neighbour is anyone. But not all thought can be considered to be coveting. So we have to ask, at what point does thinking become coveting? We get a clue, I think, from Deuteronomy 5 and verse 21, where the command is put like this. You shall not covet your neighbour's wife, and you shall not desire your neighbour's house, his field, his male servant, his female servant, his ox, his donkey, or anything that is your neighbour's. Two additions here. First of all, the addition of the field in this verse. But note too the addition of another word. And that word is the word desire. Desire. And desire is a word which has the same root in Hebrew as covet. If we take another word with the same root, that word is delight. And then we can put these two words together. Desire and delight. And they begin to show us what covetousness really is. Now, neither desire, not even a strong desire that is implied here, nor delight are intrinsically wrong, are basically wrong. It's a fact, isn't it, that God has actually given us many things, both spiritual and natural, to both desire and to delight in. But like everything else God gives us, it's easy for us to misuse or abuse the feelings he gives us. As Christians, we should have a desire to please God. That's clearly not wrong. Paul tells us that in 1 Corinthians chapter 14 and verse 1. He tells us to eagerly desire spiritual gifts. Sorry, that's 1 Corinthians 14, 1. Nothing wrong with that desire either, is there? And along with spiritual desires, there are natural desires. Natural desires which we have and which are not wrong. For example, we have a desire for love, a desire for happiness, a desire for friendship, a desire for so many different things which are not wrong in and of themselves. And as well as the desires, there are delights that we have. As Christians, we ought to delight in God. We ought to delight in Christ. We ought to delight in the Word of God, the Bible. Such delights are clearly not wrong. And again, there are natural delights as well that are equally not wrong. Delight in God's creation. Delight in love. And so we could go on. Desire and delight, when you think about it, very often go hand in hand, don't they? We desire the things we delight in. It stands to reason, doesn't it? When we go and buy something, we don't go and buy something that we hate. We don't go and buy something that we don't like. Oh, occasionally, I suppose we might do that because it's practical. But generally speaking, we buy what we desire. We buy what we delight in. So what is covetousness? It is, as stated in the commandment, a strong desire for something that is forbidden, for a forbidden delight, a strong desire for a forbidden delight. The case of the commandment, a neighbor's house, his wife, his servant, his ox, his ass, or anything belonging to him. It is also, arising from the commandment, a desperate desire for something that delights. A desperate desire for something that delights. Of course, we can appreciate what our neighbour has, but we must not have a desperate desire to obtain it. We can have strong desires for natural things that delight and that are not forbidden to us. But even those desires must not be desperate desires. Because when we have desperate desires, we will go to desperate lengths to get those things. Covetousness has to do with thought. It is thinking too much of the delights of our neighbour's possession or possessions, and having a strong desperate desire for them. It can also be thinking too much about legitimate delights. But why is it so wrong? It is so wrong because it leads to action. We move here to my second heading, which is the action. We've seen that there are those commandments, notably, you shall not murder and you shall not commit adultery, where we have said that not only is the action wrong, but the thought is wrong as well. That is because the thought can so easily lead to the action. And in this 10th commandment, the thought is forbidden for the same reason, because it can so easily lead to action. And in fact, obedience to this commandment will help our obedience to commandments 6 through to 9. Conversely, disobedience to this commandment, our desires for something that we shouldn't have, is likely to lead to our breaking of those other commandments, as we see from many examples throughout the Bible. Let's look at a few of those examples to see what I mean. We can go right back to the Garden of Eden with Adam and Eve in Genesis 3 and verse 6. There we read, when the woman saw that the fruit of the tree was good for food and pleasing to the eye, and also desirable for gaining wisdom, she took some and ate it. She also gave some to her husband. It was a delight. It was pleasing to the eye. It was desirable. But it wasn't theirs. It was God's. He'd given them everything. He'd given them everything in the Garden of Eden, but had told them specifically that the fruit of this tree was forbidden to them. I wonder how many times Adam and Eve quite innocently saw that tree, delighted in that tree, admired its fruit before the devil caused Eve to add a strong desire and so to covet the forbidden fruit. Coveting was followed by action, as Eve and then Adam ate the fruit. Sinful thought turned to sinful action. There was also Achan. When the Israelites went into battle at Jericho, they were told that all in the city, save Rahab and all in her house, people and possessions, were the Lord's. Nothing is for you, it's all for the Lord. They were to go into God's treasury. But Joshua 7, verse 21 reports these words of Achan. When I saw in the plunder a beautiful robe from Babylon, 200 shekels of silver and a wedge of gold weighing 50 shekels, I coveted them and took them. He saw they were both delightful and desirable. He coveted them, even though they were the Lord's. And he acted on that thought. He took them. Coveting led to action, and that action was stealing. Now, you may feel, as sometimes we do feel, that this is a sort of poor man's commandment. You know, the rich men, those who have quite a lot, you know, they don't really covet because, well, we've got most things. But that doesn't work, as I'm sure we all know. Yes, we may feel that covetousness is something for the have-nots, but this is not so. It affects everybody, as we can see quite clearly from 2 Samuel 11. David was on the roof of his palace one day when he saw Bathsheba bathing. He saw that she was beautiful and desirable. He coveted her, and he sent someone to find out about her. And despite being told that she was the wife of Uriah, he had her brought to him and he slept with her. Coveting led to action, and that action was first adultery, it was secondly lying, it was thirdly murder. Another king who coveted was Ahab. In 1 Kings 21, we find that he wanted Naboth's vineyard to make a vegetable garden. He offered Naboth the choice of a better vineyard or the value of the vineyard. He was the king, he could have everything. So he offered this exchange. But Naboth didn't want to sell. There was nothing wrong in Ahab wanting it. And there was nothing wrong in him offering an exchange. But the moment Naboth said no, that should have been the end of it. But Ahab coveted that piece of land and went into a sulk, as we so often do when we can't get our own way. And Jezebel, his wife, saw him sulking, discovered why, and devised a plan by which Naboth was killed and Ahab got the vineyard. Coveting led to action, and that action was lying and murder. My final example, just to make sure that we know it's in the New Testament as well, comes from Acts chapter 5, the story of Ananias and Sapphira. They saw all the believers sharing together, sharing what they had, and they wanted to be part of it. So they sold their land, and they brought part only of the proceeds to Peter. Now, that was their prerogative. They didn't have to bring everything. But when Peter asked them whether they had brought all the money, they said yes. In essence, what they were doing was coveting the money that they got. We've given all this away, that's great, but we want to keep something for ourselves. And so they said, yes, we've given everything. Coveting led to action, and that action led to their lying, and it also led to their death. So we can see in these examples not only that coveting leads to action, but that coveting can lead us to break the previous four commandments as well. Indeed, it can make us break all previous nine. And we can see too, I'm sure, that even something like a rebellious child coveting their own way could well lead to action that would break the fifth commandment as well. There's a whole family here. It's not just possessions. Have you seen that person who can play football better than you can? That person who can sing better than you can? That better who can play the piano better than you can? That person who's much better at their schoolwork than you are? That person who's much better at this or who can do that? Covet those gifts. We can also covet someone else's wife. Not just in a sexual way, but almost in an intellectual way. We can say to ourselves, look what his wife can do. Look what her husband can do. I wish mine could do that. I want mine to do that. Coveting covers a whole range of things. And we have to be aware of that. So sin begets sin. But let me tell you one more thing before I move on to my final point. And that is to remind you how Paul actually saw covetousness. In both Ephesians 5 and verse 5 and Colossians 3 and verse 5, he refers to the covetousness as what? As idolatry. He says covetousness is equal to idolatry. Why is that? Because our hearts are desiring something on earth that has taken over our desire for God. And in a sense, we're saying we're not satisfied with what God has given us. We're not satisfied with what God is giving us. So remember that too. Covetousness equates to idolatry. So if covetousness is the seed here, not only of its own sin, but also of others, is there something that will kill it? Is there something that will kill this seed of covetousness? Well, for the answer, we're going to turn to my third and final heading, which is the remedy. There are, I believe, two things to be done. The first is to be like Paul and recognize the sin. That's the first thing. Don't go all coy. Don't go all self-respecting and say, I don't covet. Acknowledge the sin. Acknowledge those things that you're likely to covet. Be aware of them. Don't pretend it doesn't exist. And don't pretend that it is something you're immune from. We saw in Romans 7 that the moment Paul saw this part of the law, he could see how covetousness in all its forms was something that he was guilty of. And if it was something he was guilty of, how can we expect to be immune? We need to be aware how easily covetousness can take hold of us. Remember Adam and Eve. Passing that tree time and time again. Looking at it. How many times are we passing that shop window, looking in at something that we fancy, we like, we want, we delight in? The more we go past, perhaps the more the desire we have to buy it, to want it. Covetousness. Covetousness can come simply with a glance or a look. It can come suddenly or over time. It can come to the haves as well as the have-nots. And remember too, that covetousness also includes doing something legitimate to excess, to the detriment of your family, to the detriment of your spiritual life. That's the first thing to do. Recognize the sin and do something about it. The second thing is to be like Paul again and be content with what you have. As Paul writes to the Philippians, he says in chapter 4 and verses 11 to 12, I am not saying this because I am in need, for I have learned to be content, whatever the circumstances. It's our problem, isn't it? We're not content, whatever the circumstances. I know what it is to be in need. And I know what it is to have plenty. I have learned the secret of being content in any and every situation, whether well-fed or hungry, whether living in plenty or in want. Contentment. Being content with our lot, whatever it is, will help us overcome covetousness. We see this again as Paul writes to Timothy. He says in his first letter, chapter 6, and verses 6 to 10, but godliness with contentment is great gain. For we brought nothing into the world, and we can take nothing out of it. But if we have food and clothing, we will be content with that. People who want to get rich fall into temptation and a trap and into many foolish and harmful desires that plunge men into ruin and destruction. It's absolutely true, isn't it? For the love of money is a root of all kinds of evil. Some people eager for money have wandered from the faith and pierced themselves with many griefs. And the writer to the Hebrews, he makes the same point. Chapter 13 and verse 5. He says, keep your lives free from the love of money and be content with what you have. And then he goes on to say this. Keep your lives free from the love of money and be content with what you have because... You know what comes next? Because God has said, never will I leave you, never will I forsake you. We have God. Are we not content in him and with him? I know that covetousness has to do with far more things than money. But the point is surely well made by these two writers that we need to be content with our lot, whatever happens. By being content, we will better be able to avoid covetousness. Well, there are, of course, other things that will help us overcome covetousness, but here are two important ones. Recognize the sin and be content with what you are and what you have. The thought, it's a sin of the mind and the heart that God knows about, even if no one else does. The action, although a sin of mind and heart, it more often than not leads to action which involves the breaking of other commandments. The remedy, know the commandment, know your own heart, and be content with what you have. The 10th commandment says, you shall not covet. We're going to conclude with the singing of All I Once Held Dear. Built my life upon all this world reveres and wars to own. All I once thought gain, I've counted loss, spent and worthless now compared to this. These were the things I was coveting. And the law said, That's covetousness. So I'm now content. All I once held dear.